I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about hearing. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. What a world one of my guests lives in. Neuroscientist Dr. Seth Horowitz, a Brown University researcher. He looks at how we hear and how hearing shapes our minds. This takes him to NASA, where he witnesses explosive experiments with a giant vertical gun. He explores the racket made by underwater creatures. And as I said earlier, he climbed the Eiffel Tower to see what could be heard at the top. It turns out plenty. He has also been asked to design a fire alarm for people who are blind, since standard blaring alarms caused panic at a school for the blind. His book, The Universal Sense, explores the world of hearing from how our ears work to the fact that there is no silence. Our ears can hear movement in their own canals. Dr. Seth Horowitz is a researcher at Brown University. He's co-founder of Neuropop, a sound design and consulting firm. He's married to sound artist China Blue, and they live in Warwick, Rhode Island. Also joining us, Dr. Natan Bauman of Handen, Connecticut. He is has the Hearing Balance and Speech Center there. He is a specialist in tinnitus, the ringing in the ears, and extreme sound sensitivity. Welcome to you both. It's great to have you here. Dr. Horowitz, let me start with you. Good to have you on the phone.
Thank you, Faith. Good to be here.
So this idea, you stopped me in my tracks in your book when you said that there essentially is no silence.
True. I mean, anywhere there's matter and energy, something's vibrating, and that's the basis of sound. We perceive it as sound, but what we're picking up is vibration in a medium. And whether you're walking around in air like we do, or living underwater and hearing underwater, or if you're just using a very fine-grained instrument, you can pick up vibrations in space and hear the incredibly low-pitched tone of the gravity waves of a black hole. There's no place that's anything above absolute zero that's truly silent.
We imagine that space is silent. In movies about this, we don't want to hear things crashing. When we see films of the astronauts walking on the moon, we can't hear anything. And yet you tell me even the black holes make sound.
Yes, but you'd have to have ears the size of a solar system to be able to hear it. We have instruments that can pick this up. But we think of our auditory world as one that we're familiar with. We're walking around on a planet. We've got a pretty thick atmosphere. But if you went anywhere else and just listened to it, the sound would be completely different, would seem almost silent just because your ears have not evolved to it.
Well, isn't it also that, as you say in the book, we are very good at choosing what we hear?
Exactly. Part of the problem is that there's a big difference between hearing and listening. Listening is an active behavior. You actually have to bring attention to it. You're hearing 24 hours a day, even when you're asleep. But until you bring attention, which are separate pathways in the brain, most of it's just sort of going underneath, setting the tone for other responses. If you were in a really quiet environment, like I'm in sort of a rural part of Rhode Island, and it's pretty quiet around here, and something that would make me jump, say, what was that, could just be a truck banging on the road. If I was in New York, I wouldn't even notice it. And I lived in New York City for many years, so I'm very aware of the difference between basic environments. And there was something, another example is, there was something in the news just recently about how in Venice, they're going to start finding people who use wheelie bags. And if you watch people in a big city rolling around, tourists are carrying their wheelie bags, you don't notice that sound. Except in Venice, because there's no traffic, because there are no cars and no roads that act as giant low-fidelity amplifiers, these little sounds vibrating on the street sound really horrible.
Wow, they're going to issue fines?
Yes. Which I kind of think is wonderful. On another level, I'm going to have to carry luggage next time I go down to Venice.
So even wheeling suitcases, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Wow. How amazing. We're talking here, and Dr. Bauman, please join us in this conversation.
Sure.
We're talking here about sound itself, but it all, the lack of sound, for instance, people come into the studio that I'm sitting in with Dr. Bauman right now, and it is... we've got, as you know, Dr. Horowitz, we've got a lot of stuff around here that would absorb sound. And so this dead environment kind of can really, people will say, wow, Listen to the lack of something in here. So silence is kind of disturbing.
It can be. I mean, we're not used to it. And there actually have been studies that show that if things are what you think of as silent, if they're too quiet, you get populations of cells start synchronizing, and they start at a cellular level, start listening for some kind of input. And if they don't get it, after a while, they start sending out signals to parts of the brain involved in arousal. Mm. Now, arousal has a very specific meaning in neuroscience. It means turning the gain up so you can try to get any information. If things are too quiet, it makes us nervous.
Yeah. If I may just jump into this conversation, because that kind of brings me to, you know, tinnitus, okay, where tinnitus oftentimes, okay, it's a result of the synchronization, okay, that of those hair cells there, or of the firing of the hair cells, okay.
In the ear canal?
Right. No, not in the ear canal, okay, it's in the inner ear. Okay.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
And one of the things that was so really crucial in terms of some of the things, okay, that we do in terms of helping those people who have tinnitus, we provide them with the sound, okay? So providing additional sound. So there was a question of what kind of a sound would be the best sound to satisfy those people who have tinnitus. And it turns out that the best sound is the sound that normally people would perceive that there's no sound. So it's referred to as an ambient environmental sound, okay? So when people go into a room and they would say, oh, there's no sound. In fact, okay, there is some sound. It turns out that the sound that is perceived to be an ambient sound, okay, it's habituated so quickly, okay, because that's the sound that we hear from the very beginning of our lives, okay? And it's a little bit more, it's a broad spectrum of sound. It's a little bit more, you know, towards more the high tones.
But we would
basically say that there's no sound. We go into a room, okay, and that room is perceived to be a silent room.
So Dr. Bauman just said something, Seth, that really you make a comment about, and it was how fast our brains work with hearing. What's that millionth of a second? What's that number?
Well, you can detect changes that are going on the microsecond scale, and that's millionths of a second. And a lot of people have had problems with even the idea of that, because your nervous system doesn't work on that scale. We tend to think of how your brain and your nerves work by putting out, you know, a signal. It's called an action potential. It's a nerve firing, and that takes a couple of thousandths of a second. So if a nerve has to fire, it's a few thousandths of a second, how could you possibly respond to something that's going on the scale of millionths of a second? And some animals may be even faster than that. It's because our brain actually doesn't just work as a series of firing spikes. It actually, a slight change can change the bias of the whole thing. And the way you can think of this is if you go into a noisy room, as Dr. Bauman was just saying, and there's nothing particularly of interest, but there's a modest crowd, it's a restaurant, it's a bar, your brain will turn down the gain on the whole thing because nothing interesting is happening. It wasn't necessarily sending out thousands of spikes, one for every reverberation in the room, but the entire system, your brain takes it in, sort of sets, nothing interesting, drop the gain, don't pay attention, until someone shouts your name. And all of a sudden, that's a relevant interest, and everything will start lighting up in the auditory part of your brain because you heard something of interest. And that kind of shift happens incredibly quickly.
So I begin to see why you say the day-to-day function of our minds is driven by hearing.
And yet we don't pay attention to it because we don't pay attention to most of our day-to-day activities. We just kind of go through them.
It's really it is the most important, actually, sensory modality that we have. And as Dr. Horowitz mentioned, you know, earlier, okay, it's something which is open 24/7. You know, when I teach about it, I talk about the fact that we have eyelids that allow us to close our eyes when we go to sleep, but we don't have earlids. Okay,
yep.
So that basically is a fantastic example of the fact, you know, how important is our hearing modality. Okay, versus our visual modality. Plus, there is another, you know, principle, is a purely physiological principle, where if we hear a sound, that information gets to a part of the brain responsible for our survival much faster, okay, than if there was a visual input. It takes a little bit longer time to get to the same survival part of the brain. Okay, so that another example of how important hearing is.
Exactly. Hearing is 20 to 100 times faster than vision, which is why if you think about it, the fastest survival behavior you can do, you're walking down an alley, and, you know, it's dark and you're monitoring, but you can only see what's in front of you, and suddenly you hear a loud bang or you hear a quiet footstep. And what do? You jump. And you start, you're getting yourself ready to run. It's like you tense up all your muscles in your back, and you start scanning your environment. All of that happens in less than a hundredth of a second because 5 neurons connect your ear to the muscles in your back, so you can be ready as soon as you detect something to run for it. Whereas with vision, it can take you a quarter of a second for a fast visual recognition, and your vision is limited to what's right in front of you. Hearing is 360 degrees as well as 24/7.
Thinking about how powerful sound can be, and this is a tough subject, but we have seen for the longest time that various military governments have used sound to torture people. And I wonder what that's about. Are they using a frequency that is so irritating to the human mind, or is it volume, or is it the consistency of sound? What's that about?
There's a lot of mythology about using acoustic weapons. There are real ones. The LRAD is one, the long-range acoustic device. And what that is doing is using a special amplifier and a focus speaker to create a beam of sound that is just at the edge of causing serious physical harm. I mean, you're talking 140 to 150 decibels. If you were close to one of those, it would not only permanently damage your hearing, but can have a lot of other effects. There have been other studies, there have been claims such as supposedly the Marines used playing Welcome to the Jungle to torture Noriega when they were trying to get him to come out of the Vatican offices while they're trying to capture him. And it turns out that they were using the sound, but they weren't actually using it to torture anybody. They were just trying to block the reporters who were using long-distance microphones to try to pick up what was going on inside.
Mm. But yet, there's a very interesting principle regarding, sound, and maybe not that much sound, but the repetition of the sound. There's this very famous expression of Chinese torture where dripping water, which is not really loud, can really be representing a very significant, serious, problem to somebody. So this is where, speaking about the control, how much control we have over it, this is where some parts of our brain, become so tuned to a certain sound, that they're willing really to give away their secrets in some way, just to be freed from the sound. So when our auditory system is locked, into a sound, and when our attention control, system knows that we can't really get away from it, that we are imprisoned, with a particular sound, a very benign sound, could become a very dangerous, actually, weapon.
Mm. All right. So, Dr. Horowitz, stay where you are. Dr. Bauman, you two were going to take a quick break and then come back and describe this thing where you and your wife, Dr. Horowitz, go up to the top of the Eiffel Tower with a lot of recording equipment to hear what you can hear. And you'd be surprised what they can hear. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton, and we are looking at the science of hearing, which affects the development of our minds. It's been so responsible for the development of humans on this planet. Our guests are Brown University researcher and neuroscientist Dr. Seth Horowitz. He's author of the science paperback, The Universal Sense. It is really interesting reading. Also with us, we have Dr. Natan Bauman of Hamden, Connecticut. He runs the Hearing Balance and Speech Center there and is a specialist in tinnitus, which is that ear ringing persistently, and extreme sound sensitivity. We'll get into that in just a little bit. So, Dr. Horowitz, You are married to China Blue, who's a sound artist. You live there in Warwick, Rhode Island. And I wonder if you would explain, was this for a piece of hers? You went up with a lot of recording equipment, which required a lot of permission slips, up to the top of the Eiffel Tower. And what did you want to do?
Well, this was one of her projects. So she's a sound artist, but basically she's interested in exploring the sound of unheard places. And she's very good at running through paperwork, and her French is much better than mine. And we had been doing some work together, and she said she wanted to try and record this because we had gone to Paris recently. She said, I wonder if I could get permission. And she managed to work it out, and they said, you can come and record the Eiffel Tower. And the interesting part, of course, is, as you mentioned, we go with an awful lot of equipment. A lot of it was geophones, and geophones are specialized microphones that are used to record earthquakes. And they are little brass cylinders, a couple inches in diameter, on 300-foot leads. So they look like bombs. And we had a dozen of them in our luggage. So it was really interesting getting through airport security. But we got there, and we were able to go ahead and start setting up to record. What was interesting was we all think of the Eiffel Tower, we think of the top of it, and when you see that view, but some of the most fascinating things we recorded, we actually got to go into the basement. People don't realize that the machines that run this structure are all underground, and no one was ever allowed to see them at that point, and we were able to go in. And by lining entire areas of the tower, we were able to hear these very, very deep infrasonic vibrations, the kind of sounds that are so deep that you can feel them, but you don't hear them until you shift them so that it comes into the normal human hearing range. And we also were able to go up to the top and get into this escape chute area, which is between the elevators. So we have the elevators running up and down a foot to either side of us, and it's raining and blowing, but we got the most amazing sounds. The Eiffel Tower, I mean, it's all that structural iron that's over 100 years old, and it vibrates like a living thing. It's got its own song. It's picking up the vibrations of the wind moving the iron just a little tiny bit, the elevators going up and down, of all the traffic in the area. And when you take those sounds, all well below, mostly well below the human hearing range, and you shift them using audio software into the human range, it sounds like the building. It sounds like the building itself is singing.
Huh. And did you? Do I remember in when I was reading your book that you could hear conversation on the ground?
Could you say that again? You just blipped out.
Do I remember reading in your book that you heard conversation on the ground?
Oh yeah. I mean, you could hear voices filtered through the metal. At one point, China Blue was recording in one area and I was in another, and all of a sudden these incredibly loud alarms went off. And we're listening through these infrasonic microphones and we barely hear anything. But you could hear as if you had cotton stuffed into your ears. You hear the footsteps banging on the metal, and we heard these mumbling sounds, which are the people all yelling in French about what happened. It turns out something had tripped an alarm on one of the elevators. But you can hear the voices shaking the metal of the structure. And when we went up to the very top, we could hear voices at ground level using regular microphones because we were above the noise band that you usually get when you're close to the ground, which is generated by roads, which goes back to the question of Venice. Whenever you have roads and you have these massive vehicles driving on them, sound travels faster in dense media than it does in less dense media. So sound travels up to 10 times faster underground. So an entire city becomes a low-fidelity speaker.
Wow. You know, the two of you have me thinking that this is miraculous. If you take the Eiffel Tower as just one thing and what you just made of that, and then multiply it by everything that is surrounding us around the world on this planet. And then we have what happens, you know, in other galaxies. And you start to add, I mean, is it a symphony or is it cacophony? It's just amazing to think that we humans select out what we want to hear and need to hear out of all of that.
I mean, it's we have incredibly complicated systems in our brain to parse out what do we pay attention to, what do we don't. And this is why tinnitus is such a problem for many people, as Dr. Bauman will tell you, because all of a sudden some damage in your ear is making you hear something you can't turn off. And when you have something going 24/7, you suddenly have a serious impact on your life. You're relying on your hearing as being your alarm clock, as being your background monitor, and if you suddenly have something whistling or making roaring sounds and blocking it, you're losing a part of the world.
Mm. Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, regarding tinnitus, there is a very significant interference, obviously, okay, with the sound, and not only in terms of, you know, the volume or the pitch of the sound, okay, but for reasons that we think, okay, relate to the fact that it's perceived, the tinnitus, the sound is perceived as an adversary event, okay, it distracts our attention from all the other sounds. So it becomes, you know, a situation where there's one event that wins, okay, in terms of competition with all the other sounds, where the other sounds are more important sounds that we know should be more important to us. Yet that particular sound, okay, wins over all the other sounds. Mm. So our, you know, brain system is very extremely unhappy. That's a kind of a kind word in terms of having an intruder, an uninvited guest in some way, okay, to our auditory environment. Okay, so our auditory landscape becomes polluted in some way with the sound that there is no escape from.
So Dr. Bauman, how do I describe what your technique is in working with people who have tinnitus, the ear ringing or the roaring sound? What is it that you're doing? Is it safe to say you're distracting, teaching them to, are you distracting their brains, transferring the attention to something else?
Well, it's a form of basically retraining the brain of making understand, okay, that sound, in fact, is one of the all sounds that are out there. Okay, yeah. So I refer to this as trying to habituate, okay, the fact, okay, that sound, for whatever reason, becomes an unwanted predator-like event. Okay, so there is retraining process. The retraining process consists of two elements. One element is where there is a sound therapy instruments involved with this, where they, in some way, allow the part of the brain which reacts that violently to the sound become less aware of it. Okay, so there's some form of I hate to use this word masking, but there's some form of a masking, or, you know, trying to, from an auditory point of view, suppress this. On the other hand, there is some form of cognitive behavioral therapy, or getting into a little bit of mindfulness, where there's a way of retraining the brain to react to it totally differently. Okay, mm-hmm. So that it does not present a stressful event. So mindfulness, cognitive behavioral therapy is some of the things that are, you know, mm-hmm. used, okay, in my clinic.
So two tracks.
Yes.
That's interesting. I wanted to talk with you, Dr. Horowitz, Seth Horowitz, on the phone with me. His book is called The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. And it is quite an adventure to see all the things that you've done. You have gone to NASA's Ames Research Center and worked with this thing called the Vertical Gun. And this is a light gas gun, and it fires these custom-made projectiles into these targets at incredibly high speeds, so up to 33,000 miles an hour. So that's 15 times, as you say, the muzzle velocity of an M16 rifle. So what are you trying to do with that thing? What are you trying to see and hear?
Well, this is... it's actually one of my favorite places to go work. I'm working with Peter Schultz.
Mm.
And Peter Schultz is a NASA researcher, and he's the one who blew the hole in the comet and in the Deep Impact mission, and he's the one who blew a hole in the moon looking for water with the L-Cross experiment. And he's really very interested in blowing holes in things. And we've been friends for many years, and he's always interested in the impact. But if you think about it, when something hits something else, in our experience, what it does, yes, it makes a hole in it, but it makes a huge sound. Now, when typically when they were examining this, they're using high-speed cameras and making these incredibly cool slow-motion videos, trying to figure out, well, what happens if this asteroid really does land in the middle of Manhattan? Does it look like all those bad diagrams from the 1950s? And, you know, they set up, you know, little figures, and they're measuring with high-speed cameras. But I realized this is based on a comment from my wife who said, what does it sound like? And they had never really examined that. So we've gone back twice. We actually just came back about a month ago from a second run, but the idea was go and put specialized microphones in. And what you're simulating is an asteroid or a big meteorite coming and hitting the surface. And normally this is very random. You don't really want to be around them. If you'd seen any of those, the webcam footage that, or the car cam footage of that small asteroid that exploded over Russia, and another one had exploded over Indonesia, and these things make a huge bang. They blow out windows everywhere. You don't want to be near those things. And yet the sound of them is fascinating, even when you pump down the air. Now, the thing about the vertical gun is it looks like a submarine came up underneath a big commercial garage. It's this giant metal armored thing with a 30-foot-tall gun muzzle on a nuclear missile launcher, and it fires these projectiles into a target. We got to go and put seismic microphones, regular microphones, surround it, and we were able to, even in vacuum, we were able to pick up the impact. The vacuum isn't pure, and when we were discussing at the beginning, could you hear sounds in space? Well, even if you pump it down to Martian levels, Mars has an atmosphere, but it's extremely thin compared to the Earth's. And we ran an experiment where we ran it down to approximately Martian levels, and we had an impact. And you still hear what sounds like a giant sneezing. Because even though there's very little air, it's still enough to cause complete auditory chaos. And yet, from that chaos, we were able to measure how quickly the sound would move. And it helped us characterize what happens if you have a big impact and do it without relying on the hypervelocity cameras that are going a million frames a second. The nice thing about audio stuff is because there are so many people doing excellent work with music, with media, the equipment is much cheaper than very specialized scientific research gear, and yet the quality of the data is just as good.
Wow. You're making me think about how we now as humans are hearing things we've never been able to hear before because of these technology changes. And I wonder how that's affecting the human brain.
Well, you have to actually listen for it. I mean, we've heard the wind zone tighten. Back in the 70s, we heard the first recording from a spaceship. We heard from Venus, the Soviets at the time, put microphones on their probes that landed on Venus. And it was admittedly a very short recording, but they may have heard thunder. Where we can translate the solar wind into sound. It's electromagnetic radiation, but we can go ahead and translate into something audible. It's expanding our horizons. It's expanding ways that we can actually observe the universe even without our eyes. And that's critically important. There are a lot of people who really don't have great vision. I mean, I know NASA spends a lot of time, everyone spends a lot of time on putting out these 3D images, and I can't really see them very well. Never been able to do the cross-eyed things. So being able to hear things means much more to me, because to me, you look at something, it tells you something's there. But when you hear something, it tells you something happened. Being able to listen as part of your exploration is telling you what's going on more than what's just there and what to identify.
Well, I was just going to add to this that our way of enrichment comes in a lot of different ways. I mean, we hear things, we listen to things, okay. We can see things, we read things. Hearing different sounds is definitely a very significant form of enrichment of our brain.
Okay. Well, Dr. Brahman, you've talked about on this show in the past what happens when people do not attend to a hearing problem. You know, might have have to then deal with aging or a whole bunch of psychological issues. And so a lot of the conversation or experience of life is missed. And what effect does that have on the brain?
Well, you know, Let's begin with something as simple as changes in personality. Okay, it's affected very significantly with auditory deprivation. Okay, now when it comes to more physical aspects of our health, you know, things such as cognitive development of the brain, starting from very early, you know, with children. Okay, and the same thing goes, you know, with adults later on in life. Dementia is increased much more significantly with auditory deprivation again. Okay, so all different forms of physical other aspects such as cardiovascular problems, okay, GI, you know, problems with this.
Oh, yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So there are very significant, yeah, people just don't realize that depriving themselves of proper hearing, it's just most of the time, you know, perceived as inconvenience, where you know, the range of different problems, okay, from a medical point of view, mental point of view, it's huge.
Dr. Horwich, you're jumping in saying, yes, that's right. I'm so surprised about this. First time I've heard about gastro issues and...
Oh, he's absolutely right. We ignore things, but they're still there, and we're still perceiving them. And people who live around in noisy environments, there's a very strong correlation, some good studies showing causation of high noise environments and cardiovascular issues raise the blood pressure, because you can change, as I mentioned before, arousal. Arousal is a physiological metabolic measure. It's telling you how active your body is. And if you're stressed, if you're exposed to loud sounds, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up. And over time, if you live in a noisy environment, your hearing gets worse than it would have otherwise. And you have to strain even more to hear, so that you're adding another level of tension. People living, they've shown even with kids, children who live near airports or very loud urban environments do worse in school. People who are older who are living in noisy environments always have worse cardiovascular problems. And it's because of the role of hearing and arousal. Your hearing health gets ignored because we tend to think of it as, well, we all go deaf as we get older. But we don't realize that by not paying attention to what we're listening to, we speed that process up. And I have a very good friend who is an incredible composer and musician. I work with him in Neuropop, who spent way too many years with his head between two studio speakers at full volume because he liked listening to it loud. And now, largely, his hearing cuts off at about 10 kilohertz, which is half the normal human range. Mm. And it's not uncommon anymore.
Well, because of concert music, too, so loud. I'm talking about popular concerts.
Or movies.
Most recent
studies show that something like 70% of movie theaters, the sound level is above what's considered a dangerous threshold.
Okay, so both of you stay where you are. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, I want to talk about some of the underwater creatures who are so amazing in terms of the sound that they make. It's thunderous down there. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton, and I am having a great time with my guest, Dr. Natan Bauman of Hamden, Connecticut, and he's a specialist in tinnitus, in hearing and speech in general, was a professor at Yale Medical School, and he is also a specialist in sound sensitivity, a kind of hypersense about sounds. Everything sounds too loud. And also with me by phone, Seth Horowitz, who is a neuroscientist, and hearing is his thing, and his book in paperback is called The Universal Sense. It's filled with so many fascinating things. You can find out more about his book and see lots of interesting facts from his book at our website. Just go to WNPR.org and search The Faith Middleton Show. I wanted to ask you both, but Seth, you in particular, because you have a consulting firm and you're sort of involved in this world. There's been something that's happened in radio. I mean, we used to have radio theater where people were, you know, using a lot of different instruments to make the sound of footsteps and thunder and lightning and
Foley work. Yeah.
You know, all the stuff. Yes, Foley work. So now we have a kind of storytelling where sound is mixed in as if scoring a symphony. And I wonder what you all think this does to the brain. Can we hear and listen as intensely as we always have, or is our brain working on so many tracks listening to those sounds that the intensity of the content doesn't come across as usual? I've been dying to ask somebody this.
Well, it really depends on the quality of the recording and the mix. I mean, I'm sure you run into this. I've known some incredible Foley artists. Just listening to them create entire worlds in the background in real time. And I've seen them do this for films. And it's an amazing art. It's not carried out nearly as much anymore. Physical Foley takes a lot of work. When you're working with something that's pre-mixed, you've had to make decisions. What do I include? What's louder? What's softer? So that you can have more control over it, but you're also sometimes pushing it more into the background. It's really dependent on how good the person doing the work is, how good the mix is. So you can run into things like major motion pictures, like a recent one, Interstellar, where everyone was complaining about the sound. Mm-hmm. They had to put up notices like, this is the way the director wanted it to sound. And yet you can also have films where the sound absolutely makes the movie. It can be completely simple, and yet good sound quality will grab your attention to certain things, will help you move from one scene to another.
You know, the Watergate movie, All the President's Men, was like that for me. I mean, here was really a story about two people who are just sitting around, standing around, and talking. You know, I mean, there's not a lot of action in All the President's Men, but yet... The attention to this detail with the teletype machines, the typewriters, the footsteps in the garage, right?
Yeah.
The music, amazing effects. Okay, now what about this? Restaurants, I'm dying to ask about this. I read a study, this is one of these internal studies because I get a lot of food trade publications, and they said, restaurants are so noisy now on purpose, not because people don't know what they're doing, because the louder the restaurant, the higher the check.
What it's based on what Dr. Baum and I were discussing about stress and hearing. When you go into a place that's loud, it's a stressor. So that one of the things that you do if you're not paying attention to the stress is just there is that you try to do things that let you control your environment. If I'm walking into a store and it's loud and I got to stay, I will spend more because by buying things, I'm controlling my environment. This is why places that cater to teens will always have loud music playing. The kids want to go in there, and to them, the stress is revving them up. But at my age, I'm never going to go in there. Restaurants have taken these kind of marketing-based science studies that said, well, if it's louder, they will buy more and they will drink more. Unfortunately, you always do a very specific population. What it will also do is have a lot of people say, I'm never going back there again.
Uh-huh.
And we had actually worked with some people trying to develop an automatic rating system for restaurants and for gyms and even for, you know, for real estate offices. And we found so much resistance that we dropped the project because a lot of it was, no, we've been doing this, it works, we don't want to know. It's like, well, you've got people, you're damaging their hearing, and you're driving a specific population away. A loud club that's catering to young people, well, it wants younger people crowd, and it wants them in there dancing, it wants them in there drinking. They'll come, but you're also driving that population to go deaf earlier, and they become the population who will never think about setting foot in your establishment.
Right. It's so fascinating. I wonder, with these environments that are so sound-rich, we'll call it, or sound-polluted, I guess you could say, on the other end of the scale, what that does to people. There are people in life, as Dr. Baumann has taught me, who have this hyper-sound sensitivity, and for them, all sound is assaulting. It's louder than it should be, right?
Yeah.
So what's the environment like for them when they go into a restaurant or a subway or
I've only known two people with real clinical hyperacusis, and they just won't. A lot of them just will not leave their home.
There are several different, actually, sound sensitive disorders. One of them is hyperacusis, okay, where people are oversensitive to all normal sounds, that people who don't have this problem would never really perceive those sounds as being too loud. Those are normal sounds, okay. So that's one form of oversensitivity to sound. There are some other forms of oversensitivity to sound, such as phonophobia, where people are become afraid of sounds. So that's a little bit different. There's a little bit different mechanism, okay, in our auditory system, in our brain, where phonophobia is more related to how the brain perceives the sound versus hyperacusis, where it's more related to the auditory pathways, where auditory pathways in some way are turned up. So you think about it as somebody purposely just increased the volume, increased the gain.
The way it feels
in the auditory system. So that's why normal sounds are perceived being too loud. And then there is another form of sound sensitivity, okay, which is where people are sounds sensitive to very specific sounds.
So Dr. Brownman was here a while back and said to me, for instance, he had someone who was absolutely, practically hysterical over the sound, in a bad way, over the sound of corduroy, rubbing. This is how specific it can get. And that's what you're talking about in terms of the brain fears that particular sound.
It becomes, in those people who have that kind of a sensitive problem, okay, it becomes not really they react this way because of the sound, but not because of the physical aspects of the sound. They react this way because of the meaning of the sound, what the sound represents in a conscious and subconscious way to them. Okay, So the sound, which is really pretty benign in terms of its volume, okay, it's not something that should provoke such a reaction to it, okay? But they are losing the response to it, they react to it. And when somebody is not using the pathways that allow us to respond in a rational way to different events, different sound events, and they react to that, okay, that reaction becomes an abnormal reaction, and those people are people who require treatment for that. And especially this is true for adolescents who are sensitive to sound that are generated by the mouth. So chewing sound, breathing sound, okay, so normal common day sounds, okay, those adolescents, those children can become very aggressive, violent in reacting to those sounds.
Wow, this is Dr. Natan Bauman of Hamden, Connecticut. He's a hearing and speech specialist. And on the phone we have Dr. Seth Horowitz, author of The Universal Sense, about how hearing shapes the mind. And it's quite an adventure reading this book. I really enjoyed this. You say, Dr. Horowitz, in your book that along this evolutionary chain between amphibians and mammals, we humans have lost the ability to heal our brains. So if you said it's studying tadpoles is a fascinating thing because they can rewire their brains in 48 hours. A bullfrog can regrow its auditory nerve and restore function. And so if we understand that better, here's maybe a path for deafness in humans.
The problem is that there are, of course, a lot of differences between frogs and humans, even though when you study them, you begin to see the paradox of that. You can look at almost any kind of animal's brain that has a real brain and say, wow, the same basic plan is the same from a goldfish through a human. But you can also say every individual brain is as different as fingerprints. Frogs give us major insight into how we not only evolved our hearing, but we developed. Because if you think about it, we all start off living in a shallow pond. Our ears connect to the brain during the third trimester, and unborn children in the third trimester can actually hear. They hear low frequency. It's sort of like if you stuck your head in a bathtub. It's not great, but they can hear the lower parts of the mother's voice. They can hear some environmental sounds. Before then, they can't really hear because they haven't developed properly. Or they haven't developed yet. But it does give us insight into how we have learned to hear. Frogs can do incredible amounts of healing to the central nervous system. Mammals, not so much. And we still don't know quite why. There are a lot of molecular clues, but a lot of it's also probably just the density of connections. Mammalian brains have a lot more connections and are much more complicated than amphibian brains. It's not one is smarter or better than the other. It's just they've evolved for different kind of situations. Mammals have to do a lot more with their brains than many amphibians do. We have to maintain our body temperature. We have more complex skin development. And we have more complex behavioral repertoires. I mean, adult bullfrogs largely sit there. They're lurking predators. So we study frogs because it tells us a lot about our own evolution and development, but also may give us insights if we can figure out what is different and what we could apply, what genes work, what proteins are different. Maybe we can apply that and come up with a way for healing, especially our central auditory system. Mm. In the last few years, the progress has been incredible. I mean, weeks after I finished the book and turned it in, was like a sigh of relief, I started reading about, okay, someone has successfully grown functional hair cells in a Petri dish. It's like, I didn't think that was going to happen for 10 years.
Uh-huh.
A few months later, somebody had actually restored hearing in a deaf mouse by implanting proper stem cells. Not perfect hearing, but they went from totally deaf to functional. So there is tremendous progress, and a lot of this has come from research into frogs, into mice, even insect hearing. It all pays into the questions.
Wow. Okay. Now, where do you think we're going with all of this? What's next?
We're at a strange exploratory phase. I mean, we're at a point where we have incredible equipment and we have tremendous amounts of information, and what we sort of need is the time to think about it. When we think about hearing and health, as I'm sure Dr. Bowen will tell you, we tend to put it off as, well, hearing problems are issues for old people. And we don't realize that it can hit you at any time, and what you do as a young person affects the quality of your life as you get older. It seems like all mammals seem to lose hearing as they get older, except possibly bats, and we still haven't figured that one out. Because bats will live 30 years, but a bat that can't hear would slam into a tree or starve to death rapidly. But there's also, it's not just the hearing health issue, it's what you can do with hearing that people don't know about. It's not just listening to your music or a movie. Some of the research I was doing when I was at Stony Brook years ago was looking at the other half of the ear, the balance part, and how it interacted with hearing and how it interacted with sleep. And it turns out the vestibular part of your brain drives sleep. And you can actually use sound and vibration to trigger normal sleep. This became an opportunity because you can look at your ears as not only being something that's running 24/7, even in your sleep, but can also contribute to proper sleep. There are also looking at, as we learn more about how hearing goes through the rest of the brain, I started doing some work recently looking at how hearing affects emotion and attention. Emotion and tension are major parts of our health. And I've had quite a few friends, as we all get older, start having problems with chronic pain. And I realized that a lot of the problem with pain has to do with emotional attentional aspects more than the physical injury. And we're starting to carry out studies right now looking at, can you change how people perceive pain or manage pain just by controlling their attention and emotion through the use of sound? So hearing not only is our day-to-day information gathering, shaping our world, it's also a powerful tool. And only now will we be beginning to be able to understand how we can use it, use hearing to address pain, use it to address sleep, and other basic things in our lives.
I hear the sound of our theme song, and that means we have to go. Thank you so much, Dr. Seth Horowitz, author of The Universal Sense, Dr. Natan Bauman, Hearing Balance and Speech Center, an expert on tinnitus and high sensitivity to sound. Thank you so much for being on the show. As always, this show's about the richness of life. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.